From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Bush administration has been justifying its plans for a preemptive strike by comparing it to the Cuban Missile Crisis. That almost led to nuclear war. Nobody knows what this might lead to.
Cuba researcher Jane Franklin and former legal counsel to President Kennedy, Ted Sorensen. Today on Democracy Now!, then, will Lula win? The barons of international finance hold their breath as Brazilians go to the polls. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. President Bush threatened yesterday to lead a coalition against Baghdad if the United Nations failed to back him. Bush said, quote, "The choice is up to the United Nations to show its resolve. The choice is up to Saddam Hussein to fulfill his word. And if neither of them acts, the United States in deliberate fashion will lead a coalition to take away the world's worst weapons from one of the world's worst leaders." Russia, China, and France, all veto-wielding permanent UN Security Council members, toughened their stance against Washington's proposed Iraq resolution. Washington and London insist that arms inspectors who left Iraq in 1998 should not return until given sweeping powers by a new resolution. Inspectors had wanted to send advance teams to Baghdad on October 19th, but they agreed yesterday to wait until the Security Council adopts a new resolution. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix last night backed British and U.S. calls for Saddam Hussein's presidential palaces to be open to his team in an apparent hardening of his stance against Iraq. Five Iraqi civilians were killed and 11 others wounded when U.S. and British warplanes bombed the town of Nasiriya in southern Iraq. This according to an Iraqi military spokesperson. Iraq says U.S. and British aircraft conducted 55 raids over 18 areas Thursday. U.S. and British warplanes were flying over Iraq to distribute leaflets that urged Iraqi gunners to stop firing at Allied aircraft. The leaflets warned, "You could be next." The leaflets contained a cartoon showing a fighter aircraft firing missiles into a ground radar and a surface-to-air missile launcher. "Iraqi ADA, beware," read the message. "Don't track or fire on coalition aircraft." On the other side, the leaflet said, "The destruction experienced by your colleagues in other air defense locations is a response to your continuing aggression toward planes of the coalition forces." No U.S. pilot has been shot down by Iraqi forces since the Gulf War. Aid workers are increasingly concerned about a humanitarian catastrophe if a new war is launched against Iraq. This according to the BBC. A recent statement by a number of charities warns of mass civilian deaths and an exacerbation of an existing humanitarian crisis. A large proportion of the population depends on food rations through the Oil for Food program. This could be disrupted by aerial bombardment. Iraq already has some 700,000 displaced people. As we exposed here last week on Democracy Now!, the Washington Times is also reporting today that House and Senate members are saying their constituent mail is running overwhelmingly against a unilateral attack on Iraq. California Senator Dianne Feinstein, for instance, says her office received more than 20,000 calls, emails, and letters. All but 300 are against unilateral military action. Israeli Defense Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer told Labor Party ministers that a U.S. military attack against Iraq would begin at the end of November. His remarks indicated the U.S. may be speeding up its war plans. Sources close to Ben-Eliezer said that the initial assessment of the defense ministry is that an assault on Iraq would commence in the middle of December. They said the defense minister's remarks Thursday were based on new information received by the intelligence establishment. An Israeli security delegation arrived in Washington Thursday to consult with U.S. officials ahead of a possible war in Iraq. The Israeli Daily Haaretz is reporting the Israeli ambassador to the United States has rejected a report published by the German newspaper Die Zeit that Israeli Mossad agents track the perpetrators of the September 11th attacks for an extended period of time and passed over information on them to the CIA. Ambassador Danny Aiello said in an interview on Army Radio that there were no Mossad agents operating in the United States. According to the newspaper report, the CIA ignored the information on the terrorists and deported the Mossad agents. The agents rented an apartment in Florida in December 2000, close to the apartments of two of the September 11th hijackers in order to track them. Pakistan yesterday test-fired a medium-range ballistic missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead deep into Indian territory, this according to military and defense experts. The missile test came amid renewed tension between Pakistan and India, which both have nuclear weapons, over the disputed region of Kashmir. He added it will deter India from carrying out a nuclear or conventional attack in New Delhi, and an Indian official said India is not worried by the test firing. A former colonel in the Guatemalan army has been found guilty of ordering the murder of an anthropologist whose research exposed crimes during the country's civil war. Myrna Mack was stabbed to death. She was age 39 outside her office in Guatemala City on September 11, 1990. A junior officer had been found guilty of her murder in 1993. Former Colonel Juan Valencia Osorio, who was an assistant director of the Presidential Guard, was sentenced to 30 years in prison by the court in Guatemala City. The BBC reports it's extremely rare for any top-ranking military officer to face atrocity charges arising from the Guatemalan military's reign for more than four decades. Two other defendants, retired General Edgar Godoy and former Colonel Juan Guillermo Oliva, were cleared of ordering the murder. And shipments of low-cost AIDS drugs, which were intended to save the lives of thousands of impoverished Africans, have been intercepted, flown back to Europe, and sold at vast profits, this according to the Guardian newspaper in Britain. The allegations of cynical profiteering by European traders have shocked activists who've been clamoring for more and cheaper AIDS drugs for developing countries. At least 6 million HIV-positive people could benefit from the drugs, and most of those will die without them. The latest World Health Organization figures show that only 27,000 have gotten access to the vital medicines through the two-year-old UN deal called Accelerated Access. An Iraqi vice president suggested Saddam Hussein and President Bush and their top aide should fight a duel, with the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan serving as the referee. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said the Iraqi offer didn't warrant a serious response. He said, I just want to point out in the past when Iraq had disputes, it invaded its neighbors. There were no duels. There were invasions. There was use of weapons of mass destruction in the military. That's how Iraq settles its disputes, Fleischer said. The suggestion from the Iraqi vice president came a day after Ari Fleischer called for another way to settle disputes, assassination. He said, I can only say that the cost of a one-way ticket is substantially less than that. The cost of one bullet, if the Iraqi people take it on themselves, is substantially less than that. The cost of war is more than that. When asked to clarify if he was calling for Saddam Hussein's assassination, Fleischer said, regime change is welcome in whatever form it takes. And the House of Representatives is set to vote on a joint resolution authorizing President Bush to at least allowing him to invade Iraq. We're joined on the telephone right now by Medea Benjamin, founder of Global Exchange. She was arrested a few days ago when she once again demonstrated in the House of Representatives, in the House International Relations Committee. Medea, can you tell us why you did this and what happened?
Well, I think we have to disrupt them every step along the way. This was the markup for this horrendous bill authorizing the use of force in the International Relations Committee, and I think we can't let these things go unchallenged.
And Medea, I'm shocked that you were arrested a few days ago. How did you manage to get back into the House of Representatives and get past the security? Don't they know you by now?
Well, they do, but if you wait online, they're not allowed to, well, they weren't until today to keep me away. Now have been banned from a five-block radius of the Capitol. But I think it's just on an Amy that others have to step in. And every time they're talking about this bill, and especially next week when they're voting on this bill, we have to be there to not only bear witness, but to say no.
What did you exactly do in the House International Relations Committee? We know the week before you made your appearance at a Rumsfeld congressional hearing.
Well, there were six of us, all women, who have started something called Code Pink, a preemptive strike for peace. And we have been appearing all over the Capitol in the last couple of days at meetings like this. A number of the women got up and started to say that we can't go down this road. This is illegal and immoral and unnecessary war. Don't give the president these powers and unfurl the banner. They were escorted out, and then I started clapping for them and started repeating some of the same issues about how we can't allow Congress to take us down this path, and was not only escorted out, but arrested, kept overnight, accused now of disruption of Congress, which I am very proud of, and I will challenge this ban of not allowing me within the five-block radius of the Capitol.
Medea Benjamin, thank you very much. Medea Benjamin, the punishment, by the way?
Well, I don't know. I have a court date that I have to go back to in about a month, but I just want to say, Amy and Juan, one, thank you for all you're doing, and to the people listening, please let us challenge them every single step of the way, including in these kind of legislative venues.
Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange. And finally, this financial news. Charles James, the so-called antitrust chief, is resigning. His 15-month tenure was dominated by the Microsoft case and his efforts to abandon tougher penalties against it. He will become the vice president and general counsel of Chevron Texaco. And the chair of the Securities Exchange Commission, Harvey Pitt, is backing away from his choice of John H. Biggs to lead the new federal agency that will oversee the accounting industry. Industry executives complained that Biggs would be too tough on the industry.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
War Pigs, Black Sabbath, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and hi, Juan.
Good morning to everyone out there. And, you know, Amy, Robert Byrd was the lone voice in the U.S. Senate yesterday as he tried to block the Senate moving forward on the debate. And Byrd, of course, is well known for his flowery oratories, more typical of a Victorian age than the U.S. Senate in the 2002, but he said, "As sure as the sun is rising in the east, we are embarking on a course of action with regard to Iraq that in its haste is both blind and improvident." And of course, he tried to stop the debate and was voted down 95-1.
Well, we're going to continue with the War and Peace Report by talking about Bush's justification of preemptive strike. A U.S. invasion of Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein would mark a radical break in U.S. foreign policy. from a Cold War doctrine of deterrence and containment to one of launching aggressive first strikes against potential future threats. I'm actually reading excerpts from a Reuters piece on how the Iraq invasion would reshape U.S. foreign policy by Alan Eisner. In a speech made at West Point in June this year, the president laid out his plans for a preemptive strike doctrine. He said, "Our security will require all Americans to be forward-looking and resolute, to be ready for preemptive action when necessary to defend our liberty and to defend our lives," unquote. What impact will it have on foreign policy and U.S. relations with the U.N. and other nations?
In October 1962, in what is widely known as the Cuban Missile Crisis, Washington pushed the world to the brink of nuclear war. The events brought to a head the ongoing attempts by U.S. rulers to overthrow the Cuban government. The U.S. Attorney General at the time, Robert Kennedy, proposed to his brother, President Kennedy, the establishment of an operational command to direct the various plans of action in a unified, coordinated, and organized fashion and merge them into a single plan. In practice, this meant the preparation of a new covert operation, not merely by the CIA, but by the entire U.S. government. At a White House meeting on November 3, 1961, Kennedy authorized the development of a new program, much more sinister than its predecessors, designed to destroy the Cuban Revolution. The project was codenamed Operation Mongoose.
Before we turn to the legal counsel for President Kennedy, Ted Sorensen, we're going to play just a clip from a new documentary film called Fidel by Estella Bravo, which is going to be opening in New York City on October 18th. This is the clip about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Cuba threw in its lot with the Soviet Union. 1 year later, Khrushchev came up with a plan to install Soviet missiles on Cuban soil.
The missiles had a double purpose, to strengthen the socialist camp and to dissuade the U.S. from invading Cuba for fear of starting a nuclear war.
Castro reluctantly agreed to accept the missiles, but then he said, at least if you're going to deliver the missiles, make it a public act. But Khrushchev thought he could do it clandestinely and it would spring it on the Americans.
U.S. spy planes discovered the missiles, which brought the Soviet Union and the United States to the brink of nuclear war. The crisis ended when the president's brother, Robert Kennedy, negotiated a secret deal with Khrushchev. The Soviet Union would remove the missiles if the United States withdrew its missiles from Turkey and later promised not to invade Cuba.
When Khrushchev then took the missiles out without the courtesy of notifying Castro or consulting with him, Castro was furious.
And that was Arthur Schlesinger, that last comment, again, from the new documentary film Fidel, opening at the Brooklyn Academy of Music and the Quad Cinema. We are joined by Ted Sorensen, who was legal counsel to President Kennedy. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Sorensen.
I'm glad to be with you.
Your response to Condoleezza Rice talking about a preemptive strike and making comparisons back to Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
It's a totally false comparison. She said that Kennedy considered a preemptive strike during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, of course, he considered a dozen alternatives. And after he considered what a preemptive strike would involve by way of killing innocent civilians, violating international law, driving away our allies and the United Nations who were supporting us, he did not go forward with a preemptive strike, knowing that it might precipitate a nuclear holocaust destroying the world. Kennedy was a man who wanted to preserve all possible options in a situation like this. The trouble with a preemptive strike doctrine that Bush is now talking about is that it removes all the options. The only option is bombing the hell out of the other side, which doesn't leave any room for diplomacy, for conventional weapons, for a number of other possible approaches.
But this issue of a preemptive strike, a lot of people are talking about it as if it's a new policy, but there have been numerous other wars in which the United States, in fact, there's a very interesting op-ed piece in the New York Times today by Max Bout of the Council on Foreign Relations, who says we never strike first, and he talks about all the history of U.S. first strikes, even from the Spanish-American War, the Mexican-American War. So it's not an unusual tactic or strategy used by our government in the past.
Well, if we want to, in 2002, follow the examples of the Spanish-American War and the Mexican-American War, perhaps there is some useful precedent there, but I can't imagine any thoughtful, rational leader of the United States picking up either one of those imperialistic wars as an example today.
Precisely. It did seem to me like a justification of imperial policy, because he even raises Grenada and Panama and a variety of other U.S. interventions as an example of the precedent by which President Bush is operating right now.
Ted Sorensen, you wrote this letter to the New York Times, JFK, No to First Strike, and you're headed to Cuba for a 40th anniversary reunion. What is this reunion going to be about? Who will be there? And what lessons have we learned in this 40 years?
Well, the Cuban government is hosting this conference to re-examine the missile crisis, its implications for the world at that time and today. I think there are a good many implications today. Even the conference itself is instructive, because 40 years ago, when the Soviet Union, through clandestine moves of its nuclear missiles, looked as though it was preparing to eliminate the United States from the face of the earth, who would have believed that 40 years later we would all be sitting around a Cuban conference table together discussing the implications of each side's moves? It's another demonstration of what President Kennedy meant when he said at American University in 1963 that enmities among nations do not last forever. Mr. Bush seems to feel that there are no qualities worth considering in Iraq or its leadership. I doubt that he'll be sitting around the table with any Iraqis 40 years from now. But the truth of the matter is that in the geopolitical world, each side has its own history, each side has its own economic objectives, each side has its own reasons, and staring down a nuclear gun barrel at each other is no way to resolve those differences.
Ted Sorensen, former special counsel to President Kennedy. We have to break. When we come back, Mr. Sorensen will be joined by Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. Then we're going down to Brazil to look at the election that will be taking place this Sunday. Brazilians going to the polls. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Come, I say come, you sitting still in domestic bacteria. Come, I say come, you standing still in double-breasted mornings. Come, I say come, and return to the fight, this fight for the earth, this fight for our children, this fight for our life. We need your hurricane voices, we need your sacred hands. I say come, sister, brother, to the battlefield. Come into the rainforest, come into the hood, come into the barrio, come into the schools, come into the abortion clinics, come into the prisons, come and caress our spines. I say come, wrap your feet around justice. I say come, wrap your tongues around truth. I say come, wrap your hands with deeds and prayer. You brown ones, you yellow ones, you black ones.
Come to the battlefield, sweet honey in the rock. Here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest on the telephone is Ted Sorensen, special counsel former special counsel to President Kennedy, and Jane Franklin, who is author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. This justification used by the Bush administration, justify preemptive strike, comparing it to Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Your comment, Jane Franklin.
Well, one interesting difference between now and then is that President Bush and his administration are right out front. They are planning these strikes. They're not just stopping with Iran. They talk about the region. They have 26 countries now on their list that have to be checked carefully for visas. They have the seven nations they call terrorist, including Cuba. They're right out there in the open. The press spokesman gets up and recommends assassination for the Iraqi leader, Saddam Hussein. Back in the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was not an overt operation as far as the United States preemptive strike plans went. They planned Operation Mongoose, as Juan mentioned, in 1961, after the Bay of Pigs invasion. They set up Operation Mongoose to invade Cuba, and guess when that was going to take place? October 1962. That is why Cuba calls it the October crisis, not the missile crisis, because for Cuba, which knew that this invasion was coming, it was a crisis because they knew they were going to be invaded the next October. They went to the UN. The UN refused to listen. They went to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union offered weapons. Cuba took them. There was still no knowledge in this country of Operation Mongoose, which was headed up by Edward Lansdale, who had headed up the Philippines and Vietnamese right-wing administrations that Washington set up. No knowledge here by the American people until 1975, in fact, during the Senate investigations. Meanwhile, assassinations and sabotage, invasions by teams. Lansdale was trying to get teams into Cuba to carry out internal revolution, which they were hoping would take the lead in this, and so they would not have to use massive invasion. But that failed because Cuba kept capturing these people. They're very good at knowing what's going on. But I want to point out that before the missiles were discovered, the Soviet missiles in Cuba, McNamara, who said afterward that they were not in planning an invasion, although he admits now that he understands why Cuba thought they might be, he, in October 2nd of 1962, in a memo to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Robert McNamara, who was Defense Secretary, described situations that might require U.S. military force against Cuba, including placement of offensive weapons from the Soviet bloc in Cuba, a Cuban attack against Guantanamo Naval Base or U.S. planes or vessels outside Cuban territory. And by the way, we know from other declassified documents that they were planning fake attacks on Guantanamo and fake attacks on planes at the same time. He goes on to say, or vessels outside Cuban territory, any attacks. Assistance by Cuba to, quote, subversion, unquote, in other countries of the Western Hemisphere. A request for assistance by leaders of a, quote, substantial popular uprising, unquote, in Cuba, which they are now trying to create as well, have reached a point inconsistent with continuing U.S. national security. In other words, if there was enough demand from inside, they would justify their invasion. The memo requests that contingency plans emphasize removal from power of Prime Minister Castro. And then, on October 6, 4 days later, Admiral Robert L. Dennison, Chief of Atlantic Forces, receives a memo from Defense Secretary McNamara telling the Joint Chiefs of Staff to start putting into effect Op Plan 314, that's Operations Plan 314, and Op Plan 316, two contingency plans for invasion of Cuba. Then they discovered the missiles, and that almost led to nuclear war. Now we don't know what could happen if they strike Iraq.
Ted Sorensen, your response.
Well, I'm impressed by Ms. Franklin's review of the documents, but I must say there are some rather murky facts which have been misinterpreted here. Of course, there were contingency plans in the Pentagon files in the height of the Cold War in those days to invade virtually every country in the world, no doubt, including Namibia, Chad, and Burma. But that's the way the Pentagon operated in those days. They had plans for everything, but they did not intend to implement them. The President of the United States had no plan to invade Cuba. Operation Mongoose was itself not an invasion plan, but a combination of harassment tactics, subversion, and all the rest. It was certainly not consistent with Cuba's best interests, and I doubt that it would have done much to advance the U.S. national interest, but it was not an invasion plan, and when the U.S. agreed with the Soviet Union that to end the crisis, it would not invade Cuba, we were giving up nothing because we had no intention to invade Cuba.
Jane Franklin.
Mr. Sorensen, the words that I just said were that Secretary of Defense McNamara asked for those op plans to be put into effect, and that was in October. And Edward Lansdell, in February of that year, in advising the president, and this group that he was with included almost everybody in the government, as you know. I know that you weren't in on those meetings, but McNamara was, and Robert Kennedy was, and almost everybody was. And he says, Lansdell's plan says, I'm getting this from Lansdell himself, finally, in the first 2 weeks of October, quote, open revolt and overthrow of the communist regime. Now, that is what they were planning, and he decided that they didn't have the strength from internally, so they would have to do it from outside. And there was this threat of invasion. There was definitely a threat of invasion. You must talk about about that with President Castro and Vice President Fernandez when you are down there.
As a matter of fact, some years ago, I did discuss all of this with President Castro.
Right.
And the first 2 weeks in October had already long passed when the Cuban Missile Crisis began, and no invasion had occurred.
They were still infiltrating teams into Cuba, even as you people were sitting in the White House trying to decide what to do between October 16th and October 22nd. They were infiltrating teams to try to overthrow the Cuban government right then, and they did not stop. They were ordered to stop on, I believe it was October 25th, during that crisis. But they did not stop, and it went on. In fact, Task Force W under William Harvey continued sabotage and assassination efforts right into 1963. And they even put someone else in, Francis Fitzsimmons, or whatever his name was, with more assassination plans in 1963.
Well, I'd like to ask Mr. Sorensen to think of this issue in another way. Clearly, the U.S. government at the time wanted regime change in Cuba, as the Bush administration wants regime change in Iraq today. But the difference, obviously, was the existence of the Soviet Union as a counterforce to the designs of the United States in terms of these kinds of regime changes. Clearly, with the collapse of the Soviet bloc and the expansion of American power around the world, there is no counterforce anymore. Do you think that that has an effect on how our government officials today, how they regard the limits of what they can and can't do, regardless of what international law of the United Nations tells them?
I would hope that international law and the United Nations would play a major role in influencing American foreign policy at any time. 40 years ago it did. I would hope it would do in even at least in such a way today. But yes, does the fact that there is or is not another superpower with the capacity of destroying any American invasion force or America itself make a difference in the military planning? It would be a foolish military that did not take that into consideration. But I might say that 40 years ago, one of the specific recommendations made to President Kennedy was, this is your chance for regime change. This is your excuse. Now the American military can invade Cuba. We have superior conventional power with the Navy and all the rest in the Caribbean. And the wording was, this is your chance to go in and take Cuba away from Castro. Kennedy vetoed the idea.
Ted Sorensen, what about this issue that's been raised in the last few days? Ari Fleischer, the president's spokesperson.
I'm absolutely outraged by that statement. I can't believe that the United States, after over a year of preaching against terrorism, would suggest the very epitome of terrorism, namely that another country use assassination to change its president. After the tragic experience we've had in this country with assassination, how could Bush permit, without any reprimand, his press spokesman to go out and make that statement?
Jane Franklin?
That goes right to what I'm saying. Now it's right out in the open. I mean, in 1960, President Eisenhower arranged plans for the assassination of Fidel Castro using organized crime figures to do it. That continued also into the Kennedy administration. Assassination, according to Edward Lansdell, when he testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee, he said that whatever means were necessary to get rid of Castro were okay. If assassination was included, that was okay. He said that in 1975.
I don't know what that was okay means. It doesn't. If it means that was okay, had been authorized by the president, that's not a correct statement. I also submitted an affidavit to the Senate Intelligence Committee at that time and made clear the reasons why I was convinced that President Kennedy did not authorize such plans and did not know of any such plan.
But there have been assassination attempts against Fidel Castro by people who've been working with the government ever since, the latest one that we know about in the year 2000. And are those people really being prosecuted? Is the United States government, is Washington interested in seeing Luis Posada imprisoned for, of course, I have to say, an alleged plot, since they're charging him only with possession of explosives and falsified documents and holding him in Panama, and presumably with a trial coming up in December. But is he just going to walk free again when he was also allegedly responsible for the blowing up of an airliner in 1976, killing all 73 people aboard? I mean, this kind of thing has been going on constantly ever since 1959. We need to stop that.
Well, Ted Sorensen, I'm sure that when you get to Cuba and you have these discussions and look back over the 40-year history, that this will be part of the discussion that continues, because clearly you and many of the other people who are around President Kennedy are not in positions of influencing the current administration.
Well, but that's quite clear.
I noticed Mr. Schlesinger's name on the list of assignees of an opposition to an attack on Iraq as well. But it is important for us to be able to make to look back at this history and see the difference between what the public stance of our public officials is and sometimes what the covert actions that accompany those public stances.
I think it's worth remembering, and I will recall this for Cubans, Russians, and Americans at the conference next week, that President Kennedy took pains to make clear to his people, his advisors, his military, and all the rest, that Cuba was not our enemy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, that he wanted to focus on the Soviet Union, which was engaged in this effort to possibly wipe us out. And he addressed in his remarks, his public remarks to the American people and to the world, a plea for understanding of the Cuban people, with whom we had no fight at all. There were weapons of mass destruction being placed on that island. The Cubans were not placing them there. And we had to eliminate those weapons of mass destruction. That was the objective. I would hope that today, if the American government has knowledge of weapons of mass destruction being established in Iraq or elsewhere, that they would take steps to eliminate those weapons of mass destruction or any other proliferation of nuclear, chemical, and biological arms But they don't need to go to war and kill a lot of innocent people to do that.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Ted Sorensen, former special counsel to President Kennedy, and Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. Before we go to break and then down to Brazil, a few comments from our listeners on this War and Peace Report.
Hi, yes, my name is Gretchen Masters, and I'm calling from Ouray, Colorado. I loved your idea about painting something on the window of the car that I heard from the woman from the Navajo reservation. So I'm going to paint No War for Oil on both of my vehicles tomorrow. I'm thankful to know that there are other voices out there that are speaking out.
Yes, my name is Hank Decker. I'm from upstate New York. And what I'm doing to organize in this time of war is supporting the president 100%. You have nothing good to say about the United States and everything bad. And I deeply resent your program and all its left-wing fallacies. And I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I back our troops, and I back our country.
My name is Dave Heller. I am from Berkeley. You know, we're going to spend $150 billion on this war. If we really want to emasculate the Iraqis or Saddam Hussein, let's put $100 billion into a public transit system that actually works and $50 billion into getting solar power on every household in America.
My name's Bill. I'm calling from Canada. This sort of information about the American state and its warmongering is spread freely. In Canada, these ideas are broadcast freely all the time on many on the national service, on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's radio services in French and English, on television. And inside the United States, this information is not spread at all. To anyone outside the country, this is an alarming factor. A highly developed country, well, that's pretty much what it's turning into, highly developed country without the appropriate way to inform its citizens of what's really going on, and not just the citizens who care to listen, not people who are interested in action, but people who are just doing their jobs, going to the Walmart, blah, blah, blah. They need to know. And you don't let them know this by breaking their door down or standing on their lawn or standing in their flowers. It's normal human communication. At coffee break, wherever, somebody starts getting warlike at you, you let them know. You know, I heard from a guy in Canada that they think that we're the most dangerous country on the planet, that everybody thinks that, that we have the weapons of mass destruction. We're out of control. Our leadership is out of control. Our corporate structure is out of control. Anyways, love the program. You're doing good work. Anybody out there listening, this is important. Get off your butt, open your mouth, and stand up for what's right. We appreciate it because, you know, we know that Americans are good people.
Just some of the comments of our listeners that we've been flooded with over the days. You, too, can call at 212-209-2999. You can also email us at mail@democracynow.org. Listening to Democracy Now! After break, we go to Brazil. Stay with us.
Cada vez que miro a mi mulatona, no sé qué pasa por mí, no me puedo contener. Cada vez que miro a mi mulatona, no sé qué pasa por mí, no me puedo contener. Y le digo así, y le digo así, mulata, tienes en las caderas una tembladera que arrebata, mulata, tiene en tu dulce boca una risa loca que me mata.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, Brazilians will cast their votes for a new president this Sunday. And Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of the Workers' Party is leading in the polls by a large margin. Lula, as he's known by Brazilians, is a former labor leader who's run for president in the past but lost by small margins to various center-right coalitions. He's been highly critical of the IMF and the World Bank, but has toned down his criticism recently, some say in response to pressure from the business sector and international financial institutions.
The mainstream media throughout the world have been attributing the collapse of the Brazilian real to a panic amongst investors over the change in the presidency. But the crisis in neighboring Argentina indicates that it is the IMF lending policies leading to huge unmanageable debts that have led to the economic crisis in the Southern Cone. In a recent report, the Center for Economic Policy Research predicts that at current interest rates, Brazil's debt payments will reach 100% of its gross domestic product by 2009. In August, the IMF followed an earlier $15 billion line of credit to Brazil with an additional $30.4 billion bailout package, this one with even more stringent fiscal austerity programs attached. In a country of 200 million people, which arguably has the worst income and land inequalities in the world, in which the unemployment and underemployment rate is running at nearly 50%, and in which the per capita income has declined for five of the last 6 years, the vast majority of Lula supporters are not going to put up with increased austerity measures.
We're joined on the phone right now by three people. We'll begin with André Singer, spokesperson for the Brazilian Workers' Party in Brazil. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us in these last few days where Lula stands?
Well, first of all, good morning. It's a pleasure talking to Pacifica and to its listeners. Thank you for the opportunity. I would like to say that we are just 48 hours before the election, the first round, and we are very confident in our possibilities not to win in the first round. We think it's more probable that we are going to the second round on the October 27. And yesterday, it was the last debate before the first round. It was a good debate. It was a victory for Brazilian democracy because it was a high-level debate in which our candidate could expose his proposals to change the economic model of Brazil with responsibility, with dialogue, with transparency. And we are really confident in that this change is possible without any fear. I think I was hearing what you said before I could talk. And I would like to say that all the investors, the internal investors and the foreign investors, don't have anything to fear because we're going to do a very soft transition, a very responsible transition. And I think that everybody who is solid and responsible in the business sector wants Brazil to grow. It's important for everybody, and everybody can profit with it.
Well, Mr. Singer, one thing that may be of interest to Americans here who are not knowledgeable about the Brazilian campaign rules, apparently, as I understand it, in a country as vast as yours, obviously television plays a very important role in terms of being able to get a message across by candidates. But under Brazilian law, every political party is guaranteed a certain amount of television time depending on their strength, so that therefore the amount of wealth or money that a particular campaign may be able to raise will not necessarily impact the ability of their opponents to be able to get a message across. Could you explain how that works?
Yes, that's right. This is a very good question because this is a particularity of the Brazilian democracy. The political party has free time on television according to their representation on the House of Representatives. So there are proportional time to the number of representatives they have in the House, in the lower house. And so that gives every political party, every important political party, and we have kind of five important political parties in Brazil nowadays, the opportunity to speak without having to raise great amounts of money to speak on television to the whole Brazilian public, which, as you said before, being a vast country as it is, is very important to have the opportunity to be on television.
We're also joined on the phone by John Williamson, economist and former advisor to the World Bank and the IMF, currently a senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics. Your view of the election in Brazil and a possible Lula victory.
Well, first of all, let me just endorse what Mr. Singer said. I think the Brazilian system for allowing all candidates a say proportional to the size, the importance of the party they represent is probably the best system I know of. I think it's vastly better than the American system of having paid advertisements. I think it's also much better than the British system, where there's also, which I happen to know about because I am British, which it gives parties proportional time, but does it in terms of set-piece, pre-recorded programs rather than any sort of debate. So I just wanted to endorse. I think the Brazilians have really got a good, they also have a good electoral system. They all vote electronically, and it works. They'll count the votes in a matter of hours. Quite an example to other countries. Now, having said that, the really big issue here is whether indeed Brazil is a government led by Lula is going to be able to make a transition without come out without a restructuring of the debt, resolve the current crisis, which has pushed the currency down to an extremely undervalued level, which has led the interest rate on Brazilian debt to really astronomical levels, and whether that can be reversed, whether the market credibility can be restored. And I think that's going to depend very much on the actions of the new government, and in particular, whether it shows that it is capable of, first of all, implanting a solid economic team, and secondly, putting together a coalition in Congress which will be capable of passing important measures that are needed in order to stabilize the economic system. One thinks there of tax reform, social security reform, perhaps the two leading areas. And I think if the markets see that the Lula-led government is capable of doing things like that, then there's a very good chance of getting a reversion of the market panic of recent weeks.
But, Mr. Williamson, precisely about that market panic, having in effect the financial centers of the world economy been in essence trying to vote before the Brazilian voters, and basically by their fleeing Brazil, or by the impact they're having on the currency there, in essence trying to frighten the Brazilian people into how they should be voting?
Well, I don't think they did it deliberately, but I certainly think that was the effect. But don't let's kid ourselves that this is the first time this has happened. This has been an experience of many left-wing parties when they first looked like being capable of taking office in a world with a high degree of capital mobility. I actually worked in the British Treasury way back in 1968 to 70 when the UK was faced with very similar sort of problems. The pound had been devalued the year before and the markets didn't trust the government an inch, and there were periodic runs on the currency, and eventually the government showed that it was serious and that it had changed the situation, and then the markets relaxed. But government, left-wing parties have to go through this experience quite often. It's not just a Brazilian situation. It does make life difficult for democracy. I agree about that. But it's a fact of life.
Mark Weisbrot is also with us, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Your response?
Yes, well, there's a few. First of all, the crisis, and this is where I think the press has got it really wrong. The crisis is not really a result of the fact that investors are worried that Lula might be elected. That's just a trigger for it. The crisis is a result of the enormous debt pileup over the last 8 years under the current administration. Debt has gone from 29 to over 62% of GDP. John's figures would say 66%. And when you get that high of a level of debt and your interest rates are that high, they've been 16% real interest rate over the last 8 years, it's explosive, and you can do the arithmetic. We did the arithmetic. It's on our website for those who want to see our latest paper. And John's example of the, you know, of Britain is not appropriate because they were able to pay extremely low interest rates after the crisis. Brazil, I mean, you cannot imagine a world in which Brazil is going to be able to pay 1 or 2 or 3% interest rates on its debt. So when it gets to a certain level, there really is no exit. It's true that it would be theoretically possible to pay down that debt, but it would require a world that's completely different from the one that we've had over the last decade. There are other shocks. You know, there are things that happen in the world. In the last, one of the reasons for, and this is a good lesson for, of course, your listeners who know that globalization has caused a lot of harm in these capital movements, especially in countries throughout Latin America. I mean, part of the cause of this interest rate burden in the last few years have been crises in Mexico, in Brazil, not just in Mexico, in Asia, in Russia, in Argentina. These are all things that Brazil didn't have anything to do with. So, yeah, if the world is perfect and nothing like that happens, but, you know, most invest, then they could possibly not have to restructure their debt. But most investors are doing the calculation that we did, and that's why they're leaving. And it's very misleading for the press to present it as though the cause is a fear of Lula. It's analogous to our stock market crash recently. You know, a lot of people thought that that was a result of the accounting and corporate governance scandals, but that really was not it. That was just the trigger. The real cause was that we had an enormous bubble in the stock market, and there was no way you could project an economic future under which those prices could be maintained. And that's what you have with the debt. And it's really unfortunate that the press has reported this as though, first of all, that the crisis is caused by the threat of Lula being elected, and second of all, that the government has to somehow stick with the policies of the past, which, of course, are the policies that led to the crisis in the first place. So you have a whole series of failed policies that have led to this. And finally, in terms of failed policies, it's important to remember the long-term story here for Brazil, which is the same as the long-term story for Latin America and why you see so much political and social unrest. For 20 years, there's been hardly any growth in income per person in Latin America. Brazil.
Well, if I can interrupt you for 1 second, Mark Weisbrock, because I'd like to bring in Andre Singer just on one question here as we're getting near the end of the show. Mr. Singer, a lot of left-wing parties come to power or have come to power in the past with promises of basic change, only to find themselves captive to financial pressures from the international financial community. The ANC in South Africa, President Aristide in Haiti. Is there any sense on your part that the Brazilian Workers' Party, if it comes to power, will also have to basically change a lot of its positions that it's held in the past and promises to the Brazilian people?
No, look, we are really confident in that is not going to happen. First of all, because it's very clear for the Brazilian public opinion that we cannot do miracle changes from one day to another. The situation that we have now in Brazil has been consolidating itself from the last decade to now. We cannot change it from night to day, and that's very clear for everybody. But at the same time, we have made a commitment to start changing the economic models since the beginning. That means that we are going to make gradual changings, gradative changings. And if you allow me, I would like to say a few words about what I heard before.
We have 15 seconds.
Yes, okay. We are very confident, too, in that we are going to have good support in Congress. We have all the conditions to do good compositions. And I would like to say there's no panic in Brazil. The real has not been devaluating itself in the last days. You know, it was something of the last week. And we think that we are going to overcome this situation more or less.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Andre Singer, spokesperson for the Brazilian Workers Party, Mike Weisbrot of CESR.org, and John Williamson, former World Bank IMF official. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, engineer and music maestro. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!